if you want to be a guest, please email me. I have received so many emails of people that are excited and passionate about being a guest on this show. The process is time consuming. I go through about an hour long pre-interview and I determine where you'd fit best in the season. So if you've gone through the pre-interview process, or we've messaged back and forth via email and haven't gone through the pre-interview process, I'm not ignoring you. I promise. There's just a lot on my plate and I am one person. So that being said, I look forward to talking with every one of you that is interested in being on this podcast. Y'all are amazing and I honestly could not do this podcast without the support that I receive from each one of you. So thank you so much.
I think that it was both hearing what the expectations around faith were for me from a young age. My mother literally told us this a couple days ago because it was her birthday and she had all of us boys around. And she said, when each of you were born, I told you about Jesus. And so from the time that we were born, we're hearing this message. We're hearing about hell. We're hearing about all this stuff. I think from an early age, because of my temperament, my personality type, I internalized both that and the temperature of my home, which was always in conflict. It was just a very unpredictable home with my parents. They were always in conflict with each other. I was like, well, my emotions and anything that I feel will contribute to that mess. God doesn't like it anyway. Like, I shouldn't feel these things. I think that from like 2 years old on, from the time I could think in cognitive ways, like be aware of myself and what space I took up.
Welcome to the Focus on Your Own Family podcast. Fundamentalist evangelicalism impacted a generation. We survived physical, psychological, mental, and spiritual abuse. We survived the Focus on the Family movement, and we want to talk about it. Trigger warning, guests will be sharing stories of domestic violence, child abuse, and animal abuse. Please listen with caution.
This is Dave. Here is his story.
Hey, Dave. How you doing?
Hi, Stephanie. I'm great. How are you?
I'm good. It's weird to be on this side of things because you've interviewed me technically two times because it was a part one and two, but really three. I don't think I told you this, but when I went through the interview process with you, that was kind of one of those first times where I thought, I could do this. I think I could do a podcast because I enjoyed the interview process. And I thought, oh, this could be fun to be on the other side of things.
It is fun, isn't it?
Yeah. I enjoy it. And I mean, I feel kind of nerdy when I bust out the microphone. Sometimes I'm like, oh my gosh, because this is like, it's in my bedroom. It's not like I've got a cool office space where people sit in those fancy chairs and they just talk to each other. No, I've got like a bed in the background with laundry. So
I mean, that to me is way more, I think that's way more punk rock than a studio. I mean, who needs a studio?
Right?
You're in your bedroom. That's fire. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. So you used to be a pastor. Can you, just for those listening, can you explain what denomination you are with? Because it deviates from the evangelical stuff that we tend to talk about online. And also there's a big difference between where you are geographically and so much of how the rest of the country practices evangelicalism. So yeah. I would love just like a quick breakdown and then we'll get right into talking.
Yeah. So I'm in the Boston area. I was ordained in the Evangelical Covenant denomination, Evangelical Covenant Church, which like a lot of denominations sort of is different based on the region that it's part of. So where you're located, they're a little bit more liberal. In the Midwest, they're very conservative. And then out where I am, we're more on the liberal end of things. So I was a church planter within that denomination. It is evangelical, but it's on the more progressive end in terms of evangelicalism, which means that they focused pretty heavily on what they call racial righteousness. They were doing a lot of racial justice work. And also they were wrestling with the question of LGBTQ plus inclusion. They weren't great with it. They're actually pretty bad with it, but they're more liberal than a lot of our more traditional evangelical experiences were. A lot of our evangelical experiences were kind of like, absolutely not. You just don't even allow people to be in leadership or teach Sunday school classes or anything like that. But mm-hmm. within my church, my leadership team, there were people on the LGBTQ plus in the LGBTQ plus community. There were Sunday school teachers, you know, all that kind of stuff. So mm-hmm. there was room for that in that denomination where there might be not be in others.
Gotcha. Yeah. So how long were you a pastor for?
I was only a pastor for 6 years. Yeah. So previous to that, I worked with people experiencing homelessness for the majority of my adult life. And then in 2014, I got a call from somebody who knew that I went to seminary, which wasn't many people. And they were like, hey, we got this opening for an associate pastor job. Would you be interested? And I was interested because at the very same time, my father was dying. And it's one of those things where you make a decision based on like a major life event. You know how they tell you not to do that?
Yeah.
Well, mm-hmm. I did that. I don't regret it, but I did do that. And I think that's really why I made that major switch at that time.
Okay. So we're going to get into it because I want to hear more about what prompted you to go to seminary. Obviously, you know, the title is Focus on Your Own Family. For some reason, had this misconception that you weren't really impacted by Dobson. And I don't know what caused me to think that, but when I asked you, your response was like, yes, actually, I think your response was way more colorful than that.
Can I be colorful on here?
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I say a lot of things. I asked you and I was just shocked. And we normally go through the pre-interview process. I've normally just got notes from it. This day happened to work for you. And it's been a thing trying to get you and I on the phone just to have a conversation. So so here we are. When I talk about James Dobson, Focus on the Family, Purity Culture, True Love Waits, Conversion Therapy, and the list goes on. Strong-willed child. How did that relate to your upbringing?
You know, I was thinking about it, and so much of the way that stuff got distilled down to me, there were so many different avenues. Like, I grew up Pentecostal, and so we had all these messages from different Pentecostal groups and video series. I watched Fire by Night and Gospel Bill and like all these different like video series where they would always be talking about sex. And so from the time I was a kid, I was born in 81, which was like sort of the height. The 80s were like the height of Dobson. I was spanked, you know, I was learning about all these things that True Love Waits, but also there were these songs by artists like Young Boy, Young Girl. I don't know if you've ever heard this one. You got to look it up if you haven't. Young Boy, Young Girl, The Party's Over. There's all these songs about like having sex and then regretting it or making a mistake, like getting a girl pregnant or something like that. There were music videos. There were pop artists. There was DC Talk. There was a whole True Love Waits campaign. DC Talk, I Don't Want Your Sex. You know, like there were all of these songs like that. All I was allowed to listen to, That Kind of Girl as well. There were all these songs and I was only allowed to listen to contemporary Christian music growing up. So I went to church all the time. I was only allowed to listen to that. And I, from whatever I internalized, was so afraid of the potential for hell, was so afraid of punishment of any kind, of doing anything wrong, that I became a super compliant child. I was not the strong-willed child. Mm-hmm. I went inward. I feared my emotions. I feared anything that felt like it was going against what I was hearing that God wanted for me. And so I did everything right. My mom to this day will say, I don't know what happened to you. You're not the boy I raised, because I was so compliant. I did everything. And so that included never wanting to have sex until I was married. And then when I did have sex before I was married, then I was like, well, I have to marry this person. Like, mm-hmm. that's just not a question. Mm-hmm. I was upset that it happened, which name an 18-year-old boy that's upset about having sex with the person that they're with. I don't know many. And I was upset about it. I was like, well, there's no question here. This is the person I'm going to marry. And so that's sort of the way it worked out. Yeah. It was like deep in me. There's so much messaging about purity and saving yourself and promise rings and you name it, the whole gamut.
Did you, so walking back to your early childhood, do you remember listening to Focus on the Family? Do you, or so, not Focus on the Family, Adventures in Odyssey?
Yeah, all that. And like whenever, I also remember in the mornings, James Dobson was on playing in my household every single morning before school. So he had a radio program and it was on literally every morning before I went to school. I'd eat my waffles. I'd be listening to James Dobson. My mom would be.
Did you go to a public or private school?
Mostly public. I went to private up until maybe first grade where I was spanked in school. I went to mostly public school and up from like second grade on, I was in public. Yeah.
What do you remember the climate being like in your home? I find it interesting. Your mom said, "You're not the boy that I raised." Do you recall a moment or a series of moments that you made that resolute decision that I'm going to be compliant? Do you remember what led to that?
I think that it was both hearing what the expectations around faith were for me from a young age. My mother literally told us this the other day, a couple days ago, because it was her birthday and she had all of us boys around. And she said, when each of you were born, I told you about Jesus. And so from the time that we were born, we're hearing this message. We're hearing about hell. We're hearing about all this stuff. I think from an early age, because of my temperament, my personality type, I internalized both that and the temperature of my home, which was always in conflict. It was just a very unpredictable home with my parents. They were always in conflict with each other. I was like, well, my emotions and anything that I feel will contribute to that mess. God doesn't like it anyway. Like, I shouldn't feel these things. I think that from like 2 years old on, from the time I could think in cognitive ways, like be aware of myself and what space I took up, I was trying to shush myself up. So I don't know that it was a conscious decision that I can remember, but it's definitely, it was the way that I operated all the way up until I got out of my home.
What was church like for you? Because you say Pentecostal, and were you Pentecostal oneness doctrine?
No.
So it wasn't like oneness or modality. It was okay. I have to ask that because I interviewed somebody and they were Pentecostal, and oneness is a whole different thing.
It's a different thing. That's a different thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And
I was Pentecostal
and
up till 11.
Okay. Yeah. One of the things that I am learning throughout this experience of talking to people from different backgrounds, but all about Focus on the Family, is that even in the denominations, there were different degrees. It's like there were denominations inside of denominations, and Pentecostal is a fascinating one because it intersects with Assemblies of God.
Yeah.
And through that birthed Foursquare.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it's,
for sure.
If you look at Pentecostal, all roads lead back to Pentecostal. I just find that really fascinating. So you,
yeah.
Were you raised in Boston? The Boston
New York
area?
City.
New York City. Okay. So walk me through what, because like even when you're conservative, it's more progressive just based on where you're at in some cases. What was church like as a child? What do you remember?
Church was, you got dressed up, you wore your Sunday best, you got in the car with your brothers, you sat there for hours and hours and hours. People would, music would start us off. People would begin to disrobe as though they were at a wedding reception, you know, where you start dancing and then you're like, you know what? The tie's coming off now, my friends.
Then
the spirit moves. And then the shoes come off. You unbutton a little bit. You start to wave your tie around. You got flags. People are speaking in tongues. You know, I just, but my brothers and I were sitting in the back. We're kind of like that. It didn't faze you. You're just like, oh, okay, this is what it is. Mm-hmm. Sometimes occasionally you found it funny when someone would say something that sounded a little bit hilarious in the gibberish that they were saying. But mostly you're like, man, this is the spirit of God. This is what's happening. And it was hours and hours. I mean, we're there from like Sunday school in the morning, you know, 9 o'clock until 2-3 o'clock. No food, because you're just worshiping God. And that was from the time I was from the time I can remember, where I went to Love Church on Long Island, all the way up until I was about 11. We were in that kind of a church setting. It was just church all day. And then Wednesday, then Friday, mm-hmm. you know, all the different variations of it. But it was very loud. It was come to Jesus all the time. I think I accepted about 5,000 invitations to altar calls, you know, mm-hmm. It was all that sort of stuff. One time I was prayed over so that I could get, you know, be baptized with the Holy Spirit, which would mean spoken tongues, you know, and I had to fake that or else it would have kept on going forever. Mm-hmm. Again, a compliant kid. I wanted to make sure that everyone was good with what I was, even if it wasn't real, which was devastating for me too. So I had this internal struggle, you know, of being in this space, wanting to please God, sometimes feeling it, sometimes not, but just like wanting to make everybody happy and going along with it. My brothers eventually dropped off when they became teenagers, but I kept going. Yeah.
Did you subscribe to Breakaway magazine?
Breakaway. Oh, Stephanie, that's a blast from the past. Yes, of course.
I mean,
who didn't?
Well, who didn't? I didn't because I'm female.
I know, right. What was the female version?
Oh, it was Brio.
Brio.
Yeah, it was Brio. I also didn't get, my sister got Brio. I did not get Brio. I got, because my sister is 6 years older than I am. So she got that. And I got, there's like a, it's not Clubhouse. It's, maybe it is Clubhouse. Yeah. It's their kid one.
I
think it's Clubhouse because I also got a magazine subscription called My Big Backyard, and that was through Nat Geo. So I know, okay. Right? Because there's
very
science.
Very progressive of your family.
right. That went, it left as soon as it was there. So progressive is not a word that I would say to describe my family. But,
no,
yeah, I want to, maybe it's Clubhouse. Somebody will correct me. I'm positive on that. But Brio, I remember covers of that magazine. And I remember thinking, this talks about like boyfriends and girlfriends, and it's so taboo and it's for older girls. And, being so curious, wanting to know, what is this thing that like, why is it that people are attracted to each other? What draws people to each other? I was so curious at such a young age because I'm not feeling or experiencing those feelings at the age of 7 or 8 because I'm 7 or 8. But why is it that I'm told I have to dress a certain way? And why is it that it says on a magazine, the top 10 things that boys really want in girls, and like just being so curious about things and also feeling so much shame and so much sin with something that is so natural. I don't think that I was able to put that into perspective or into the words that I needed until I had my own daughter and I see her. And I see how just like the natural progression of her world and how she naturally starts to be concerned about how people are viewing her. And that's a very normal, natural thing. But what the church did, what James Dobson did, is he capitalized on that time because he was a child psychologist, right? So he capitalized on that time. He knew they're going to start caring what people think. So we're going to start filling their brains with shaming them with just so much sin and shame. Now, instead of just being concerned, oh gosh, did I do something embarrassing in a classroom? Now it's, What if my shirt is cut too low and it causes that 45-year-old man to stumble when I'm 10?
Right.
Those are the thoughts that we would be overwhelmed with and consumed with. But I'm curious, what was that like to be on the other end of that spectrum with being male and having breakaway and being the ones that's, this is the 10 things I look for in a girl. What was that? What were you like as a teenager? Lad. Were you that dude at youth group that had his hands up high and was like, Jesus only? That's all. I'm sold out. I'm sold out for Jesus. See you at the pole, that sort of thing. Or were you, dang, she's really cute. I got to pretend I love Jesus so I can hang out with her.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
I'm somewhere in between. So
awesome.
I was, I remember, I'll start off a little bit. I was probably 12 years old when they started to teach sex ed at the public school I was at. Now I'm in the Boston area. And I was in a public school, and I'm the only student that was not in health for sex ed. My mother found out, thanks to, you know, James Dobson and all of the lobbying that they would do and educating parents about this stuff. They found out that they'd be teaching this stuff. My mom found out. So they requested that I not be included in this class. So what did I do? Well, I went to the library and I watched Little House on the Prairie while the rest of my class was learning about sex. Now, that affects me in a lot of ways, socially and otherwise. I did not know what ejaculation was. I didn't know anything. So when I started to experience puberty, there was all other layers of shame when things would happen that were unexpected. And I thought it was God punishing me for having bad thoughts. So when I, bad thoughts, meaning lustful thoughts about girls. And so, yeah, so take it to youth group. I'm having those thoughts because I'm a teenage boy who is, you know, cis, het, you know, all that sort of stuff. I was looking at girls. And at the same time, I was desperately trying to please God. So it wasn't like, ooh, I got to pretend like I'm a good Jesus guy. Like, I really wanted to be. And I was super into the girls, but I couldn't figure it out. I couldn't figure out the balance, and I didn't know how to talk to girls. I just, like, it was a whole mess. And then it wasn't until I got to high school when I got friends, like real friends in public school that were girls who weren't, like, who were older than me, that were kind of like older sisters to me, that they ended up teaching me a lot of stuff that I'm really grateful for. If it hadn't been for that, I don't know how long it would have taken me to sort of crack out of all that isolation and bubble.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Thank you to those that have reached out with your support. Whether you have left a review, if you haven't left a review, this would be a really, really good time to leave a review. I read every single one of them. So thank you. And for those that are subscribers to my Patreon, thank you. It means so much. One of the new features that I am adding for my paid Patreon subscribers is the chat feature. And this is just a way that we can all continue this conversation that we're having in the podcast. And if you are not a paid subscriber, unfortunately, the chat feature won't be available to you, but you can be a free subscriber and you'll just get the weekly newsletters. Y'all are amazing. And I honestly could not do this podcast without the support that I receive from each one of you. So thank you so much. Yeah, it's interesting. I think I had another, pretty sure I had another interview where somebody was also saying the same thing, that they had to go to the library and they either watched something or read something while the rest of the class was experiencing this. Little House on the Prairie is so specific. I'm curious, was that given to you by the school or by your parents?
So my mother provided the school with a VHS and I had this is so nuts. I had, like, you know, one of those mini TVs with the VHS in it. Was like, they gave me a spot in the library where I could watch it. That's legit what I watched in public school when everyone else was taking health class.
What episode?
That I don't remember, but I'm sure my mom does.
It's probably not the one with sexual assault. That's what I'm going to guess.
Oh, I'm confident of that.
They got a little risque. They did. They went a little risque with that one. Because I remember watching that as a child and being like, I don't understand. What's happening? Like, why there's a clown? Like, what's with the clown in the forest? Like, should I be afraid of clowns in a forest? Like,
yeah, you should be, yes.
If I see clowns in a forest, I'm actually going to be very afraid.
Rightfully so.
What Dateline episode did I jump into? What was the message in your youth group around purity culture? Did you experience, you said that there were promise rings. So did you experience like the purity pledge? Did you have a promise ring?
Yeah. You know, now that I'm thinking back, when I was in eighth and ninth grade, there was the town that I was a part of did a whole article on my church for doing this purity pledge. Now we all did the pledge, the whole youth group, but the only person that got a ring and that sort of made the newspaper was one of the girls in our group. She was a year older than me. She was on the front page of the paper. They were just doing this story about how this youth group, these youth are promising to not have sex until they get married. And basically that Jesus is their boyfriend until then. And so like she got a ring. I didn't get a ring. I had something else that was sort of my promise.
What was that?
I don't remember now. I'd have to go back. But my memory around some of this stuff, honestly, I believe is a bit stuffed and stifled. I have not necessarily dealt with all of the internalized shame around sex that I have from my childhood. I have not, my therapy has not gone there yet. I'll say that. There's lots of other things to uncover.
So we'll many. It's a treasure trove.
It is, right. But I remember this vividly because she got pregnant in a year. So this girl that was on the front page who promised to never have sex ended up getting pregnant. It became a whole story, you know, in the church, you know, had this whole scandal and everything. It's just like, yeah, I mean, the one kid in the entire town in high school that gets pregnant is this kid that makes a promise to Jesus that she won't have sex until she gets married. You know, it's just a little bit ironic. You have to wonder what it was that compelled that, and maybe the lack of education, the lack of, you know, talking about these things openly, who knows? But yeah, she was the one that ended up having a kid and had to drop out of high school.
It's unfortunate, right? Because with proper education around birth control and safe sex, it probably wouldn't have ended that way. And
or the support of her family too, when she did. Yeah. You know, like she could have had other supports. It just, all of the factors that led to those kinds of events happening, they don't prepare you. What they prepare you for is to keep completely pure, I have that in quotes, in a society that is worldly in their mind. What it doesn't prepare you for is if in any way you enter into that worldly sphere. It doesn't prepare you for it. You have no idea what to do once you're swimming in those waters.
Yeah, I agree. That kind of brings me to my next thing, gender roles. What was being fed to you about gender roles? Not just your own that you identify with, but the church only believed in two.
I think that might be a personality thing. You know, for me, in terms of gender roles, it was very clear. Man's the head of the house, man, pastor, woman, silent in church, all that sort of stuff. And as I got older and even, a little bit more progressive, and I was like, maybe women can preach, but I would never go to a church with a woman pastor, you know, like it sticks with you. I eventually got through all that, but that was clear. The gender roles were clear. For me, it was intimacy with women has always been very difficult. Intimacy in general, sharing my emotions to this day is very difficult, which might explain why you thought that maybe I didn't have some of those things. I think I might have a rougher exterior. I keep a little bit less, I give a little bit less of the things that still to this day I struggle with internally that are vulnerable for me, which prevents intimacy. So I sort of learned that that was not okay for whatever reason, that I needed to, that a man, my father was like this big Italian guy who was like very patriarchal. And, you know, I sort of like, that's a man. Okay. That's what a man is. And so when I became friends with girls, you know, in high school who were older than me, they educated me a lot. They were great for me. They thought of me as a kid brother, but you know what? It was easier for me to go to public school than my final 2 years of high school in which I was in a private Christian school. It was easier for me to be in the world, but not of it, you know, to be, a Christian who was like, it was like, well, they're clearly, they listen to Nirvana, Pearl Jam, Tupac, Biggie. Like that's of the world. I don't have to participate in that because I'm a Christian. And so I had this, like, it was tough because I didn't get along with people. I didn't know how to relate, but I wasn't tempted to be worldly. You know what I mean? I wasn't tempted to be worldly until I went to Christian school and saw my Christian friends doing those same things. And that's when I got confused. And, and then I had relationships with girls my own age, not girls that were older than me. And that's when it got a little bit more difficult for me to, hold on to my purity views the way that I had them when I was younger. And relationships really were just kind of like, well, who am I going to date? That was more like junior, senior year of high school and beyond.
So you mentioned early on that you felt like you had to marry at 18.
Yeah.
Did you get married at 18?
I got married at 22, but I married my high school, the person that I was dating in high school. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What was that experience like? So I already know that you went to college because you went to I'm going to guess you have your bachelor's and your master's. What was that experience like? First off, where did you go? And then did she go with you? Walk me through that.
Yeah. So I was going to go to Liberty University, of course, right? In Virginia, where Jerry Falwell,
gold standard.
That's where my brother went. But I started dating this girl my senior year of high school, and she was a Nazarene, which I'd never heard of before. But Nazarenes have a little college in
Dobson.
Quincy, Massachusetts.
Dobson's a Nazarene.
Yeah, right. So I didn't know what that denomination was, but there was Eastern Nazarene College in Quincy, Massachusetts, which was very close to where I live. And I knew she was going to go there. So I'm like, okay, I'll go there. Fine. That's where I ended up going. That's where she ended up going the year after me, because she was a year younger than me. And we dated for most of college. We broke up for like 8 months, but yeah, stayed together. She was the only person that I had sexual relations with. We did that in high school and through college. Then even when we weren't dating for 9 months, I didn't sleep with anybody else. Although I kissed other girls, like I still had in my head, like I can't go there yet. And I never got the chance to, because we got back together 9 months later. So, you know, and I didn't break up with her. She broke up with me. I wouldn't have chosen to do that. From my perspective, when we had sex, which is, and I'm not trying to like blow up her spot. No one knows who she is, but she wanted to, I didn't. I absolutely did not want to. I was committed to not doing that. And I was very upset when we ended up doing it. Even, you know, I'm not trying to abdicate responsibility. I participated. but it was the kind of thing that I kept saying, like, no, we really shouldn't. Like, God's not going to be pleased with us, kind of thing. And so when we did, it was kind of like, we knew, we saw in each other, like, well, we're together now for life. And so that was 18 years old. We ended up getting engaged when I was 21. Got married at 22 and we're married for 16 years. Yeah. Have 3 kids.
When was it the point where you just decided, I can't do this anymore with church? Walk me through that. What
Okay.
Your 20s were like, were you devout in your 20s?
Yeah.
Did it happen so in your 30s?
I went to seminary when I was 26. And I went simply because I was really dissatisfied in my corporate career. And I was kind of like, well, the only thing that matters in this life is Jesus. And so I should learn more about Jesus. And so that's what I did. I went to seminary just to do that. And it wasn't like I'm going to seminary now. It was like, I'm going to take a class every now and again. So I took like one class at a time while I worked full time. And I took night classes. So like 2 years in, I'm doing that. And then I started working with people experiencing homelessness. And that royally fucked up my faith. What it did basically was everything I was learning in the classroom, everything I had learned from my childhood. I'm like, well, none of this seems to make sense, but it should make sense because these are the people Jesus hung out with. So like, if the gospel doesn't translate here, then I don't understand. What's the point? So I started to lose my sort of beliefs around the age of 28. And I was in a preaching class, I remember, in seminary, 28 years old. And like 15 minutes in, I'm like, fuck this. Like, why am I going to stay in a preaching class? I'm not going to ever become a pastor. I don't even know if I believe this stuff anymore. 28. But what ended up happening for me was like, that was when I deconstructed. I was in seminary. I was deconstructing. We didn't have terms for that then. That was, you know, 14, 15 years ago. And so, you know, as time was going on, I became like stronger in my like faith in terms of discipleship and Jesus, but I didn't really know about the whole, you know, theological stuff around God. But sort like by the time I was 33, 34, I'd given up. Like, I was leading music in church all up to that point. And then my father died, and I was like, well, I don't even know if I believe anything anymore. Mm-hmm. And that's when I became a pastor.
Oh, solid.
I became a pastor when I didn't know if I believed any of it. Yeah.
Isn't that most pastors though?
Like, yeah, you know, I think it's a lot of pastors, but a lot of the ones that I knew were pretty earnest and they really did believe it. And it confused me because I'm like, wait, don't we kind of like we're iffy about this stuff, right? No, they're not iffy. A lot of them are not iffy about it.
Yeah.
They're genuine. A lot of them are genuine. I got to say, that's where I come from a different vantage point on this conversation a lot of times, you know, in the deconstruction space, that I know the people that lead a lot of these big churches. I know them. And I know a lot of the ones that are disingenuous and a lot of the ones that are genuine. Like, they really believe the shit they say. And I don't know which one's more dangerous, but I think they do equal damage.
That's an interesting thing to talk about too, because it's easy to fault the ones that are genuinely doing this to exploit people, take their money, and get rich.
Yeah.
But there really are people that are also doing that, that believe their own doctrine. They believe the name it and claim it. I 100%. Knew so many people that were completely bought into this concept that it's where they tie in the American dream with religion.
Oh yeah.
There are many of them. It's hard to be able to figure out who is who, but again, you don't know which is worse, because both people will absolutely allow themselves, will sacrifice themselves on the same altar.
Yeah. Whether it's for personal gain or to please God, it ends up being the same result.
6 years though, where you doubted, I wouldn't even say doubt, like you just didn't believe. What is that like to pastor in that? Did you deal with imposter syndrome?
It was doubt. It was doubt because I'm actually not that different today than I was then. Mm-hmm. I'm still not doubt. It's just kind of like, I don't know about all the deity stuff. Like I struggled with that, but I actually felt the most sort of secure in who I was and what I was doing. I'm like, I know this shit. Like, I knew the Bible really well. I really believed, and still to this day, call myself a person of faith who's been deeply inspired by the life and teachings of Jesus as I understand them. Mm-hmm. That was true then, it's true now. And so I would teach Jesus. I would teach the Hebrew prophets. There's so much wisdom and there's so much beauty in the text that I loved learning alongside rabbis. And like, it was a beautiful time for me of like, of understanding things at a new depth, of participating in social justice efforts. I loved it. It felt like the best fit for who I am as a person.
Mm-hmm.
And then my divorce. And you can't stay a pastor and go through marital strife. You can't get divorced for sure. And so that sort of brought up for me, can I have integrity and be an evangelical pastor? I decided, no, that I cannot. And then that started to invite other questions around, what do I think about all of Christianity, like imperial Christianity as a whole? And that like around 2018 and 19, I stopped being a pastor in 2019, was where my head was at. And I just couldn't do it anymore.
Yeah. One of the things that I've talked about before with people is that we really loved what we did. There were aspects of it that we didn't like, but I loved being up on stage and singing. I loved leading people. I loved having these in-depth conversations with groups of people. It fueled me.
Yeah.
And when we leave, we lose all of that.
It's all gone.
It's not just grieving the loss of your religious heritage.
Yep.
It's grieving the loss of all the relationships, but then grieving the loss of your ability to be productive.
That is so true. Oh my God, that's so
true. That's what you knew. We were trained to be that. And then what does the Bible say about that, right? Like, well, you're lazy because you're not being productive. And if that's the only thing you know that causes productivity,
yeah,
you lost that.
Right.
And
I blame all of it. Like, I look at all of it, the messages that we're talking about from earlier. It's like the way that I learned to objectify women, the way that I learned to be ashamed of what feelings I had, the way that I had felt like I couldn't have a voice, all of the things that I internalized from my childhood, from the things that were implanted in me before I was even 5 years old, I believed those things and still to this day hold on to those beliefs about myself. And unless you've done some real child healing work, the likelihood is that if you're listening to this and you grew up that way, you've got that shit too. And I think this is why these conversations, Stephanie, are so important, because we have to begin to unravel all the ways that this web is weaved, because it just affects all these different parts of us. Now we're on the other side, and it's, what does friendship look like in our 40s? What does productivity look like? What does sex look like? What does intimacy look like? All of these questions we're left wondering now that we've left behind that shit. Mm-hmm. It's not like, okay, we got it now. We figured it out now we have more questions. And that's kind of painful. It's difficult.
Reparenting has shown up more for me while parenting than in any other circumstance, because I can hear the echoes of my past, of past leaders, preachers, parents, friends, parents, like all of that. I can hear that coming out of my mouth. And in real time, I'm like, rewind. Like, I didn't.
Yes.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to say that to you. That's not how you should see yourself. So challenging. It's challenging to have this discussion with my boys about purity culture. It's the things that come up that you don't expect to, right? Like, he wanted to go to a Young Life thing. I know, but it can.
That's not how that one works.
I finally decided that if it's Young Life once a month that he wants to go to, fine. But I told him, you're not going to any of their camps. You're not going to an evangelical youth group. And I have concessions that I absolutely will not make.
That's so, Stephanie, I feel for you in that situation. My daughter once went to a youth group and was like, why are they talking about Jesus so much? Like, I know. That's how fucking insidious these evangelical groups are. That a kid who knows and who has a parent who talks about this stuff would be like, no, that's not what you're talking about, because they're so good at disguising it and shifting and molding.
Yep.
They're so good at it, which means now, I'm sorry to tell you this, he's going to want to go to that youth group. He's going to want to go to that camp because it's so intoxicating. We all know this. It's like, so, oh my God. Now, this is part of the book. I'm writing this book on dethroning Imperial Jesus. And the beginning, I talk about my parents' generation who were hippies. But the Jesus movement brought all of these other people that weren't really feeling the drug thing, but really were discontented in culture. And the evangelical movement got its biggest push during that movement because they're so good at adapting to making it look like the culture a little bit, but giving people a place to belong and making them feel like they're whole and they have found their, because who doesn't have insecurities and anxieties? Like, they're so good at telling you Jesus will fill all of that. And so they fill you with all this bullshit and now you're stuck. I feel for you. I feel for you with your son right now.
Yeah. The thing is, he has a memory of what it was like. He remembers. He very much, like, I remember when we stopped going and he just said, I didn't like church because I felt like I had to be somebody that was different and you and Dad were different. He could see that we put characters on.
Yes.
And he knew. I don't fear for him so much. I think Young Life is designed to be harmless until
you
go to their camps. And then it's, you know, a week of indoctrination. But
100%.
They're really just designed to be a safe space for kids to hang out. And then at the end, they might be like, Jesus loves you. And if you want to know Jesus, come talk to us. They don't pour it on as heavy once a month, but they will as it progresses. I find what you said interesting and accurate because the whole Roe v. Wade, that was a cover for Falwell's need to have his institution segregated.
Right.
And the only reason why, because he needed to get this Christian movement behind him. Basically, it all came down to he wanted money. And if he, because he was a blazing racist, he wanted to keep his institution segregated. However, he couldn't for tax purposes. And he wasn't getting anywhere passing laws.
Mm.
I know you know all this, but for the sake of the podcast. So he was trying to figure out an in. How can I get an entire movement to galvanize? What can we do? Us evangelicals, what can we do? And he saw that, was it in Michigan or Minnesota, that there was a church where somebody was putting out pamphlets of, oh my gosh, women's rights. Like, women shouldn't have these rights. This is terrible. They shouldn't have the right to abortion. And he saw this going on. He actually, at least from what I read, he saw that Dobson couldn't give two shits about abortion at the time. He didn't care.
Wow.
It wasn't impacting him. There was no, they follow the money. It's not impacting him. But Dobson, also a blazing racist, was on board with whatever Falwell wanted to do as far as being racist together. So Falwell sees how saving unborn babies was causing this entire thing up there to galvanize. He's like, wow, okay, so evangelic up there, like, they're really into that. They're really into save. It's a whole movement going on up there. So he adopts that. And then we have Roe v. Wade. Yeah. And we have the birth of the evangelical movement because he was able to get, and by the way, because of this, it was a distraction and he could get all of his other stupid racist shit done.
Yeah.
But we have the birth of a movement and here we are. And the whole point, none of them, even in the first place, gave two craps about unborn babies. They just wanted money and power. And they saw an easy way to do that. And they thought, we can now influence politics. We can influence this. What is it? The Seven Mountain Mandates. It's terrible. And here we are. And it all started with some white men wanting power.
Well, isn't that the story, right?
It's all the things. Yeah.
The interesting thing about it is that I always talk to my mother or any other fundamentalist that I talk to. I'm like, you guys talk about the Bible being the most important thing, right? How many times does the Bible talk about abortion? How many times does the Bible talk about gay marriage? How many times does the Bible talk about sex out, like from with teenagers? Like, the things that the Bible talks about the least, they major on. They major on them. Like, the Bible does not talk about abortion. At the best, the Bible has six clobber passages, I put them in quotes, about LGBTQ plus people, which it doesn't. You know, if anyone has spent any time studying these texts, they know it doesn't say what they want them to say. But the things that they talk about the most in the Bible, with the Hebrew prophets, Jesus, about caring for people who are oppressed and doing justice, where are the Bible-toting people for that? They're not there. They don't care because they've been so effective in communicating this thing that was driven by pursuit of power and wealth, and people have all sort of hook, line, and sinker bought it. And here we are today as a result with that whole group of people, the people that raised us supporting Trump and this whole MAGA movement. That's all like our people. That's our people. It is just a wild thing I never would have imagined in the 80s and 90s because it had like these, like, it seemed okay. It was nice. It was a place to fit in. And we kind of were good. Like, we didn't do drugs. We didn't have sex. You know, we were good people, right? It's like you do, and that's like, that thing is so scary to me that anytime it sounds like a nice place to be where people aren't doing anything dangerous or risky, like, watch out. It might be a cult.
Yeah. Exactly. The thing with the evangelical movement, they play the long game. They've always 100%. Played the long game. Democrats don't. No. They don't play the long game. They don't. One of the things that I'm really trying hard to, especially in this election year, to really drive the point home is talking about what our childhood was like. Because if people want to stop the evangelical movement, they need to stop looking at those that have all of these PhDs and political science degrees and everything. And they need to start talking to us, the ones who were raised to take over the country. Yeah. That was our goal. We were an army for Jesus, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I may never march in the infantry, ride in the cavalry, shoot the artillery, right?
But I'm
We're
in the Lord's army.
Yes, sir.
Yes,
and
sir.
And we need to start listening to those voices.
Yeah.
Because we are the voices that know how to dismantle the institution at the very foundation.
So true.
They're looking highbrow, and the evangelical movement isn't that complex. They're actually really easy. It's just, you have to talk to the people that were raised to be the next generation to run it. And
that's the truth.
That's what I think is the most important, but there's so many people that just get sidetracked with it and they want to listen to people that have a plethora of degrees. And that right there is the difference between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, because the Republican Party, but the Republican Party will take anybody. Doesn't matter if they have an education. Why? Because Jesus doesn't call the equipped, he equips the called.
There it is.
Where Democrats are like, we want education. We want knowledge. Yeah. And if you want to defeat that, you got to go it's with those that were raised that way.
It's too much head stuff. Like, there's just never going to do what you want it to do with these folks. Which is why, I'm convinced empathy will get us there. I'm convinced remembering who we were and being able to connect with that, as painful as it is, that's been my goal over the last couple of months, is like, all right, I need to rethink, like, what do I want to be effective or do I want to be right? I want to be effective. and I can be right along the way. Like that, if I want to be effective in changing hearts and minds of evangelicals, then I have to remember and have empathy on them and figure out what it takes to connect and change those minds, more hearts than minds, really.
So you talked about your book. One of the questions that I like to ask at the end of these is, what are you doing to end the cycle of trauma in your community, in your family, in the world? And I, because you have an influence, you're on social media, I feel like I can say the world because TikTok, Instagram, all of that reaches. What are you doing?
Yeah, I think like you, it starts with my kids. I think about my kids. I'm learning about all the ways that I can be a more conscious parent. So I focus a lot on educating myself around conscious parenting and recognizing what it is that's happening inside of me when things trigger me, when I'm parenting them. And then it's, you know, my platforms, the podcast, the TikTok, all that sort of stuff, where I communicate ideas that I think are helpful for people who are on the path of deconstructing and might still be interested in what faith might look like. Well, you know, I'm not interested in any kind of institutional faith. What I am interested in is helping people to discover the ways that they've been duped, talk about Jesus in ways that I've understood him, and, you know, sort of educate around anti-racism, Imperial Christianity, and then also that's taken the form of a book. So I do a lot of like more educational content than now. And I also do a lot of like sort of connecting. I have a lot of Christians that follow me, but they tend to be, they tend to not be white Christians. So I'm trying to figure out how to reconnect with sort of white evangelicals. I'm changing my hashtags a bit to sort of ask questions of evangelicals to get on the Christian side of TikTok. So that's the way that I'm trying to change things. I'm trying to dive back in, not to be a pastor again. That's not going to happen, but I want to invite conversation with people that I still call my people. They're still my people. As much as I don't subscribe to that way of thinking or being anymore, they're still my people. And so I'm going to get my people, and that's the way I'm trying to do it.
Yeah. And your podcast is great. I obviously am a fan. I was on it, but the direction that you have taken is it's purposeful, dismantling racism and really, really taking a deep dive into what that looks like inside of evangelicalism, inside of the very fabric of our society. You're doing a really good job. I don't even know if I'm like the right person to be able to say that. Honestly, I appreciate what you're doing. It takes boldness because it's a topic that is difficult. I appreciate your podcast and the voices that you're bringing on. Really powerful. So you're also writing a book. Mm-hmm. You briefly mentioned it, but I'd love for you to.
Sure. Yeah. I'd love for you to share a little more. So thank you for the kind words. I appreciate each part of the journey, right? So like I'm lucky to have had the happy accident of going to a place in my 20s that like fucked up my life. And that's why I've been on this anti-racism journey within myself for a while. I'm grateful for that. And so now the book that I'm writing, it's called Dethroning Imperial Jesus. Basically, the concept is this, that Imperial Jesus was invented in the second and third centuries CE. Mm-hmm. And since that time, we have lost within Europe, like Western European Christianity, that includes Catholicism, that includes all forms of progressive Christianity in the West, that includes evangelicalism. I use the expression Imperial Christianity now because even those that fly rainbow flags have internalized a view of Jesus that I think is quite problematic. And so I walk through this whole journey of how he has shapeshifted throughout the centuries and also sort of connected to my own personal journey of experiencing evangelicalism And it's there's a lot of deconstructing whiteness in there. So it's like, it's this combination of deconstructing Imperial Jesus and deconstructing whiteness and everything in between. Yeah.
It's interesting. I had a guest on last season. Her name is Davida. Incredible, dynamic human being. She's a person of color, and she talks about that, how she's like, we were kings and queens. And then the Roman Empire comes in and steals it from us. They steal Jesus, who was not white. Jesus looked like us.
Right.
And they steal him from us, and they turn him into this idea that oppresses us rather than being for us. And
100%.
Then everything that supersedes that, it just gets bigger and bigger. It's this snowball that is completely out of control now.
Mm-hmm. If you want to see Jesus, what Jesus would have looked like or how he would have been, just take a look at the Palestinian people right now. Mm-hmm. Just take a look at what they're experiencing and what they have to endure. Take a look at that. And that's more like Jesus. He would not be behind any kind of religion that exploded to 2.2 billion followers and use anything other than, cross-carrying way of being, like to live. Like, so that's my goal, is to actually think about how we can move through our anger and our frustration and our sadness and find community in a way that appreciates the thing that precedes all this bullshit, give it the respect that it deserves and sort of throw away all the other shit.
Yeah. So I'm going to ask you three questions. What's your favorite book? What's your favorite movie? And then I'm going to say it. What's your favorite song or the song that you're listening to right now?
Okay. My favorite book, I'll answer this in two. The book that kicked everything off for me in my 20s was The Cost of Discipleship by Dietrich Bonhoeffer. I don't even know that I'd love it now, but my son's middle name is Dietrich as a result. My favorite book that I say still makes me a person of faith is The Cross and the Lynching Tree by James Cone. He's the father of Black liberation theology. My favorite movie, that is always a hard question for me. Can I do TV series instead? Mm-hmm. My favorite TV series is The Leftovers and Watchmen. Love those two shows on HBO. And then finally, favorite song that I'm listening to right now with my daughter is...
Is it Taylor Swift?
No, it's KN95 by Kendrick Lamar.
Okay, I'm going to look those up.
Okay.
thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
For being here. I would love to have you back sometime. Thank you. You have become a great friend, and you are a lovely human, and I feel very fortunate to know you. So thank you.
Likewise. Love you, my friend.
Yes, same.
Peace.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much for listening. Please make sure that you are kind to yourself and to others. If you are interested in supporting this show, please click the link at the bottom to my Patreon. These shows take a lot of time and resources, and any support is appreciated. If you are interested in being a guest, please email the show at focusonyourownfamilypodcast@gmail.com. Inside of the show notes, you will find the links to mine and the guests' socials. Please give us a follow. We look forward to talking with you and connecting with you.